All right, this talk, as I said in the previous talk, if you're in the right place and I'm in the right place, we're talking about boys and girls in the upper school years. Is that right? Some things in this egalitarian age of ours have to be repeated over and over and over again. One of the tenets that we need to keep reminding ourselves of is the fact that boys and girls, like men and women, are completely different. Okay? This is not a crime or a sin. Well, actually, it's not a sin. It might be a crime by now. And because we don't know, because of a number of hidden philosophical assumptions, we don't know what to do about it. We don't know how to respond to it. We don't know, and some of these hidden assumptions of ours are things that we surreptitiously borrowed from the world without knowing it. Some of the problems that we've generated have been homegrown problems that we've generated in the church all by ourselves. We have false notions of childhood, false notions of innocence, false notions of romanticism, false notions of all sorts of things. And when it comes to boys and girls together, we have difficulty sorting it all out. One of the fundamental assumptions, there are two fundamental assumptions actually that I want to begin by addressing before I get into this, some of the particular things that are on your outline. One of the things that we got from the world is that God, if God is not sovereign, if God is not exhaustively sovereign overall, and the world maintains that he is not, if he exists at all, his existence is not relevant to what we're doing down here. It's either an absentee landlord deism, he doesn't care, or it's something they don't even pursue that far, they're just agnostic, they don't care if there's a God or not, or it's a functional atheism that doesn't take God into account at all. If there is no entity, no God occupying the God spot, we don't find that people then say, oh, I'm glad that tyranny is gone, and then they go off and mind their own business. What the sinful heart of man does is realizes that if there is not a sovereign God over all, that means there's a vacancy in that spot. And if there is no God occupying that place, we are going to aspire to that place. Right? So, as Francis Schaeffer put it, if there is no God above the state is God. If there is no God above the state is God. If there is no God above mankind, mankind is God. Man becomes the measure of all things, as Protagoras said in the ancient world. Man becomes the ultimate measuring rod, the ultimate measuring stick. And that means that when we look around at the world and there is no overarching authority above us, we are the ultimate authority. That means we can rearrange the furniture however we like. Okay, we can rearrange the furniture however we want. And this is, and there are all sorts of people, surgeons, genetic engineers, pop artists, Michael Jackson, who say that we will not be content with any boundary whatever. Right? I want to challenge every boundary. I want my personhood to be an inert mass of Play-Doh that I can push and shove and shape into whatever shape I want for the time being, and then if I get tired of that, I can go to do something else. This is the philosophical assumption. It's a postmodern philosophical assumption that undergirds the drive for homosexual marriage, that undergirds the denial of the difference between the sexes that is behind women in combat, that's behind androgyny, unisex clothing styles. What we are saying is we are exercising our right to rearrange the furniture. We're saying, okay, there is no God. Christ is not Lord over us. He's not going to tell us what to do. So consequently, we can invent anything we want. You can be male, straight male, straight female, you can be gay, you can be lesbian, you can be transgendered, and if the United Nations comes up with any two additional categories, we'll add those. And then we can come up with three additional categories, and we add those. Now, this is where it has to go. Okay? This is where it has to go. There's no... as the philosopher once said, he who says A must say B. Right? If you put this series of assumptions in motion, it's going to come out the other end. That's one problem. That's one difficulty. This is basically in the history of philosophy, we began with the Christian worldview. Then people backed away and adopted deism, where God was thought necessary to create the world, wind it up like a clock and let it go, and then he walks away. He's the absentee landlord. And then you have okay, we've got the clock, we can dispense with the clockmaker. Now we've got this clock that works miraculously and wonderfully, but nobody made it. That was modernity, right? So you'll have physicists and scientists and logicians telling us the laws of how the clock works, okay? But they rejected the clockmaker, and now you have the postmodernists who are saying, in effect, there is no clockmaker, there is no clock. It is a clock if you want it to be a clock. It can be something else if you want it to be that, right? So what do you want it to be? This assumption of the infinite malleability of the human race is what lies underneath a number of your dress code problems. Why can't I express my own individuality the way I want? And what I want to do is untuck my shirt, right? You're not letting me be me. You're not letting me mush the Play-Doh into the shape that I want it to be in. Now, it may be a very mild instance of this, but that's the pressure, that's the zeitgeist, that's the air that all these kids breathe, that's what they hear on the radio all the time, that's what they've got on their iPod, that's what they're doing all the time. You've got to express your individuality. Okay? And there's an assumption of no limits. You can express your individuality however you want, and you can push the Play-Doh around as long as you are breathing and able to push it around. So you can, to take a phrase that would have been entirely nonsensical to John Calvin or Jonathan Edwards, you get to reinvent yourself. You ever heard that? Reinvent yourself. What does that mean? What sort of limits are there on that? Well, this is the world we live in, and that is that set of worldview assumptions, that zeitgeist, is pushing on your kids. And part of your job as educators is to teach them to identify that, teach them to see it. If all you do is make them tuck their shirt in, okay, all you do is say, shut up, this is a Christian school, tuck it in. We're bigger than you, tuck it in. Now, sometimes you're not bigger than they are, but sometimes it may be necessary to just simply enforce and go on. But somewhere in the curriculum, somewhere in the instruction, you need to be teaching them why you're doing what you're doing. You can't just teach them that you must do this, because all you're going to do is instill a series of prejudices. What you want to do is give them an education. You don't want them to have irrational reactions with no explanation. I remember a number of years ago, there was a young girl in one of my classes. She was in the same class as my daughter. And she was particularly afflicted with the sin of identifying everything as awesome. It was a common failing, but she was particularly given to this. Everything was awesome. And I determined that I was not going to ever let it go by in that classroom. And I would launch into one of my favorite little diatribes. God is awesome. The Grand Canyon is awesome. Your quiz scores are not awesome. All right, the boy you met is not awesome. And I remember telling her one time, because I would just call her every time it came up, awesome. No, that's not awesome. I said, you know, I can't make you, I want you to know that I understand that I can't make you stop saying that. But I do want you to know that every time you say it for the rest of your life, you're going to think of me. Say awesome, then you turn around and what's Mr. Wilson going to say about that? Well, these things come up in Christian schools, and in the Christian school, you've got all these kids that are being indoctrinated in the assumption that the human species is just a bipedal carbon unit, and if that, and we can morph and shape and reinvent and rediscover and reassign whenever the whimsy takes us. And if that's the case, then nothing is more incoherent than saying that marriage, for example, is between a man and a woman, one man, one woman, one time. Right? What's that? Well, that's boundaries. That's the way. That's a fence. And God says, okay, past this fence you may not go. So that's one assumption that is that's going to be behind a lot of your dress code problems, a lot of behind some of the behavioral problems, behind some of the relationship problems, and so on. The other assumption that comes, this more homegrown in Christian circles, conservative Christians have often been romantic or sentimental on the subject of sex, sexual relations, the relationship role, the roles between the sexes, and so on, and we would just rather not deal with those subjects. We'd rather not teach on them. We'd rather not get into it. We'd rather the girls be just cute little girls and the guys be cute little guys and just hope for the best. Well, let me tell you, as a pastor of 30 years, that doesn't work. If you hope for the best and you don't teach and instruct and instill God's way, God's standards, and a love for those standards in these kids, what's going to happen is you're going to have kids walk into the buzzsaw of erotic attraction without being equipped at all, right? And that's one of the worst things you can do for somebody is to leave them singularly ill-equipped for something like that. Because there's a reticence among Christians to talk about the fact that when you go through the Bible, and particularly the New Testament, and you see all the instruction that the Bible gives on lust, on sexual attraction, on sexual sin, and there's a great deal of it, and it's not teaching for the men, okay? It's teaching for Christians. It's not teaching for the men. It's teaching for Christians. That means that if you need to know how to do it when you're older, you need to start learning how to do it when you're younger. You need to start processing this carefully. Now, that doesn't mean that before kids hit adolescence, they are not going to know what sorts of temptations you're talking about. And you shouldn't be talking about it that much, but you should be addressing it. Here's a good example. When boys don't develop the fascination with girls that they do because they volunteered for it. Okay? They didn't volunteer for it. They're going along minding their own business. Minding their own business, thoughts full of their paper route and getting on the team and baseball and that sort of thing. And then at some stage in their life, 12 or 13, God floods their body with testosterone. Just whoom. He didn't ask for that, didn't fill out any forms, didn't request it, didn't sign up for it, but it is coming at him like a freight train. Now, you tell me, if there's a little kid, little boys are appetite driven. Little boys are appetite driven. They are, and boys and males, men, are like a dog pushing a rock. Very singular minded. Okay? When a dog pushes a rock down the sidewalk and then pushes it back, they've got one thing on their mind and that's what they want to get done. Well, a little boy is oftentimes dictated to by his passions. But his passions at that level are two-year-old passions. Temper, wanting the best toy, hunger, physical hunger, fits of rage, whatever it might be. The boy has temptations with passions. his appetites and his passions. Now, what you want to do is instill in the boy the concept of self-control before the mother of all appetites hits him. Okay? If you indulge his appetites, especially moms, if you indulge your little baby, right, what you're doing, you pamper him, cater to him, pick up after him, don't let the neighbor boys knock him down, don't, you know, if you just cater to him, what you're doing is you are trying to create years of grief for your future daughter-in-law. That's what you're trying to do. Boys need to learn discipline and self-control. They need to be managed. They need to have it instilled in them. And boys thrive under it. Not when someone's a petty, tyrannical dictator. Not that. But just think of it as the ideal coach, a great basketball coach that the boys would go to the end of the world for, and who works them like nobody's ever worked them. It's that kind of relationship. Boys thrive when someone teaches them discipline and self-control. Boys thrive on it. And when you teach them discipline and self-control when it comes to their favorite toy, or waiting their turn in the athletic competition, or sharing with their sister, or not being the showboater that dominates the classroom, when you're instilling self-control in those areas, what's happening is you are buying for yourself some way of managing the boys when they get to an age where girls are this pressing interest. Because once you get to that age, the girls are not going to help you at all. Okay. They something happens to them too. And this brings up another point. It is not the case that in this fallen world, there's a temptations to lust and a temptation to unlawful sexual attraction and so forth. There is a temptation, there is reciprocal temptations according to the nature of the child. The boys have a fixed male nature, the girls have a fixed female nature, and it's not true that you can be anything you can be. The boys are going to be men and the girls are going to be women, and that means the boys want to want and the girls want to be wanted. Okay? The girls don't want to want the same way the boys want to want. The girls want to be wanted, and the boys want to want. The boys want to be attracted, and the girls want to be attracting. Right? The girls want to be attracting, the boys want to be attracted. And of course, if you've got a school with no discipline, indulgence, catering to whims, standards go over, just nobody's ever disciplined for anything, no people don't follow through, and you cater to that all the way through the elementary school years. When you get to the junior high and high school years, and the world is telling these kids, you're not living if you're not in a relationship. You need to really express yourself this way. You need to be sexually interested, sexually active, sexually pursuing. The advertising tells them this. Shows tell them this. Things that they hear on the radio tells them this. This is what they're going to have drummed into their head. And you've got a lot of years to prepare them for that onslaught. And you need to do it. And you don't do it by having doing sex ed classes for the third graders. That's not how you do it. What you do is you have a disciplined and godly school where discipline is a coherent concept. Everybody understands it. The need for self-control is a coherent concept. Everybody understands that. And when you step across certain boundaries that God established, certain things follow. Discipline happens. God is not mocked. A man reaps what he sows. And so, the best thing you can do, and incidentally, I would argue on the side that this is one of the best ways. Don't buy the story that classical Christian schools cannot have an athletic program because what you need is a library, not a gym. No, what you need is a library and a gym, long term, and you need people on the team in the gym who have been in the library. Okay. So the current abomination that exists in our college and intercollegiate athletics, where you've got colleges have allowed themselves to be, you know, semi-pro farm teams, and the education doesn't matter. What matters is the team. That's an example of getting everything out of whack in a way that we just need to reject it root and branch. But some people rejecting it root and branch have then said, well, so we want a classical Christian school where everybody is just sort of all the boys are little pencil-necked geeks, and they're quiet and docile, and if any of them act up, we'll give them some medications. And better discipline through chemistry. Just hit them in the head with a chemical rock if they start acting too much like boys. Well, no. What you need is to teach, instill, drill. As a pastor, I can tell you one of the best ways to find out how people are doing spiritually. I think this is a secret of church retreats. Is you can find out where everybody's doing with the Lord by just getting up a volleyball game. You know, how's everybody's spiritual condition? Well, he's not doing so good. Right. He's yelling at his teammates. He's playing all the positions. He doesn't know what it is. It's grab me. Well, athletic competition brings a lot of things to the surface that if you deal with them, you're not just dealing with those issues. Does that make sense? It brings stuff to the surface, and if you deal with them, you're not just dealing with that particular issue. You're also dealing with a host of other issues. So, all that said, that's my introduction. I'm going to take certain things as axiomatic in all this. At the center is the assumption that girls should be educated as rigorously as the boys are educated. I think that we should have no truck whatever with the patriarchalist assumption that girls need not fill their pretty little heads. And the reason for this is that men and women are created in the image of God together. They are intended to work together. And the level to which we educate our daughters will be a fair predictor of the level to which our grandsons will be educated. Okay? The level to which you educate your daughters is a fair predictor of what level your grandsons will attain. If you want ignorant daughters and well-educated sons, then what you're doing is you're saying, I don't want any of our sons to marry any of our daughters. Because if, you know, after, I think there's a line in P.G. Woodhouse somewhere, after 2 years of him saying something at breakfast table and her blinking and saying, what? ready for divorce, and I can't handle it. Men need a help meet. Right? They need someone comparable to them. And part of that is education. All right. So there is in the conservative Christian world a movement. I don't know how big it is or deep it runs, but I've encountered it a number of times. You know, it's not insignificant. And I just wanted—I don't want anybody to think that what I'm saying has any sympathy with that at all. And I think that part of what's driving this is male insecurity, this is how it works. Men know that the Bible says that the wife is to look up to her husband, is to respect her husband, is to follow his leadership, and the best way to do that and be lazy is to have an uneducated woman, right? In other words, my wife and I had two daughters and a son, all of them married. Now, we took them all through Logos. And as Nancy put it, she wanted our son to marry a woman that he would have to stand up for. Right? He wanted our son to marry a woman that would be a challenge to him, that he, in order to be a leader to that woman, he would have to stand up as tall as he could. Instead of browbeating women and keeping them down so that you can step in and get respect and honor and never have to really do much to earn that respect and honor. So in other words, there's two ways to approach this. If men are to be leaders, if men are to be initiators, if men are to take responsibility, then one of the ways you can get there is by spurring the men on. Another way you can try to get there is by holding the women back. Right? If you hold the women back, then okay, the pressure's off. So I don't want, I believe everything that the Apostle Paul ever wrote about headship and submission in marriage. I believe that the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church, and as God is the head of Christ, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11. I believe everything he said in Ephesians chapter 5 about the husband loving the wife as Christ loved the church, and the wife honoring her husband as the church does Christ. That is a given. But every conservative, Bible-believing Christian who believes in headship and submission marriage has to deal... There's always a ditch, as I like to say, on both sides of the road. You're going to have people who take that and run with it in what I call a masculinist direction, and then you have people who react against it in a feminist direction. Right? And in the masculinist direction, people are adapting themselves to this infinite malleability of the human species in just a different way than the feminists are. The feminists are trying to say that women need not be women, right, the way God made women, and the masculinists are saying that men need not be men the way God made men. What we need to do, G.K. Chesterton said that art, like morality, consists in drawing the line someplace. Right? You need to fix it, say, where did God put this line, where did God establish the definitions, and how are we going to work and labor to cooperate with that, to grow and flourish within God's design features. So, what I'm saying here is not masculinist, it's not patriarchalist. At the same time, I do believe that if your school doesn't have masculine leadership, you're headed for trouble. I believe if you don't have men who are teaching in the school, you're going to have difficulty with your boys at some point. I believe firmly that we need to have male leadership. We need to have men who take responsibility. We need to have all those things, but taking responsibility is not the same thing as trying to be the boss so you can blame other people. Right? That's not taking responsibility. So, with that said, at the same time, we have to reject the feminist heresy, root and branch. Men and women have different callings under God. And this means that they must be educated in accordance with that calling, in line with it. If men are called to one thing and women are called to another kind of thing, not to different planets, but to different callings in the one world, working together with the opposite sex, then your education is going to have to equip them to do this. So you want boys who are secure in their masculinity, and you want girls who are secure in their femininity. And they have different callings, and you educate them accordingly. I remember when our oldest daughter, Becca, we started Logos School her kindergarten year. Becca, out of our three kids, Becca has always been the cheerful guinea pig. Didn't have anywhere to send her to school. We started Logos School when she was headed into kindergarten, and we opened her kindergarten year. And then when she was getting through high school, her test scores were very good, very high, and I don't know how it works, but somehow people find out about this, and she started getting mailings from Christian colleges all around the country. And I concluded from these mailings that she was getting that the purpose of Christian higher education was to eat pizza, ride horses, and make lifelong friends. Because that's what the brochures promised. Color, slick brochures. Nothing about the education, nothing about the books we're going to have you read, nothing about, you know, what are you doing? And it became clear to me that Becca was all dressed up and no place to go. And what she had received at Logos, who were going to handle it? So we started New St. Andrews College. And she was in the entering freshman class, and there's four kids the first year. Becca was one of them. And we have about 130 now, as God has blessed, and we're very grateful for that. But Becca got, I remember saying at Becca's graduation from New St. Andrews, I was privileged to give some remarks, and I said to Becca that why did we have you read all that Herodotus? Why did we have you read Herodotus? Why did we do that? Well, it's because we wanted you to be a godly wife and mother. That's why we did that. Why'd we make you learn all that math? Why'd we have you learn trig? So you could be a godly wife and a mother. Now, The world's propaganda has said, if you want to be a godly wife and mother, all you have to do is be able to read enough to make biscuits. Right? And, all you have to do is be able to get along, make pancakes, biscuits, carbs to keep the guy happy, and have an ability to get pregnant. That's what the world says being a homemaker is. It's a slander. Right? It's a grotesque slander. And so, when I said to Becca, we want you to, because I've got two grandsons, she's got five kids now, two of them grandsons, and I want my granddaughters to have the same education, because I want my great-grandsons to have an educated mother. Well, as God would have it, the man she's married to, Ben Merkel, has been, this last year they've been in Oxford, England. He's just finishing up his master's at Oxford, and he may be going on to get his PhD at Oxford. And Becca's over there in the UK with five kids and no classical Christian school within shouting distance any direction. So she's homeschooled. Now, what would that have looked like if she said, Herodotus, what's that? Trigonometry, what's that? Right? If we hadn't educated her, and God called them for the space of a year or 2 years in the UK, and there's no schooling available, what's going to happen? Or if she has her kids at Logos or at another classical Christian school, you all know what it's like to have a family where the kids are capable of doing the work, but the family culture is not supportive of, I don't see the point of Latin. Right? The sort of comments you get around the dinner, what's Latin for? I don't see why they're making you do that. I dropped out of high school when I was 15, and look at me, I'm doing okay, you know. And the kids buy into that, and you can have a kid who's fully capable of really excelling in school, but the family culture is dragging them back. The family culture is holding them back. If you have your daughters embrace the value of this education, and they marry men who embrace it, that woman is going to be a helpmeet to the man as they seek to bring up their children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. So, men and women have different callings under God, but this does not mean that they don't need, right? This does not mean that they don't need to be educated. They just need to be educated with a different focus in mind, a different direction in mind, no understanding the calling that God has called them to. And that may involve teaching. It may, when our kids were going through Logos, when our youngest daughter, Rachel, was in third grade, Nancy thought, I've got a, she's a very capable woman, very talented, and her kids were all in school a big chunk of the day, and her domestic responsibilities were taken care of pretty quickly and promptly. She thought, I could teach. I could spend some time teaching. Doug's up at the school, and all three of my kids are up at the school. I can go up, I can be up there, and I can be involved. And so she got involved and became an English teacher at Logos for 9 or 10 years. And then she resigned that position when our oldest daughter, Becca, had her first child, because it's time to be a grandma. So the family does not, education is not a substitute for family. It's a tool that you use within the confines of the family that enables you to do what you need to do. So it's an instrument. And so the fact that Nancy was educated, my daughters are educated, that's not instead of having a family, as the world tells you. Well, you need to get an education so that if your family, if you get a divorce or your family falls apart, you have a career to fall back on. It's education versus family. It's not education as a way of loving God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, whether we're men or women, as we love God with our brains, we are then enabled to love our neighbor with our brains. Right? We're enabled to love our neighbor with our heart, soul, mind, and strength. So, men and women have different callings. But so do different men have different callings. One man is a soldier and another man is a dentist. Those pursuing these different callings should receive the same basic education that will be applied in different ways. You're giving an education that will be applied differently. This is because, although they have different callings, they have one Lord, one faith, one baptism. They live in the same world. And It is the same with boys and girls. So the dentist and the soldier live in the same world, although they have different callings. Men and women have different callings. Boys and girls have different callings, but they live in the same world. They're to interact with one another. They're to help one another, complement one another. And in many cases, the same math is necessary. Right? So when you're trying to figure out the square of the hypotenuse, the triangle doesn't say, well, are you male or female? Are you building a roof on a house or are you making a quilt? Because the square of the hypotenuse is the same whether you're making a quilt or whether you're figuring out the angle of the house, right? I remember vividly one time my daughter Becca had a friend who was from a family that didn't believe in rigorous education for daughters. You know, daughters don't need that. They just need to be moms. Okay, and so Becca, who was classically educated, got together with this friend of hers because they were going to do some work on a quilt, and they went to design the top of the quilt, and Becca was using all this trigonometry to design the top of the quilt, and this other girl was just, I just have to follow along. In other words, it's what use are you putting it to? What are you doing with it? But the math itself doesn't care, right? It's how you apply it. And if you're checked out, if you're intelligent, if you're educated, and you are pursuing your calling, lawful calling as a man, you're going to find uses to put this to. If you're a woman doing the same thing, you're going to find uses to put this to. It's not like if you're going to go down the man road, you're going to need a brain, and if you go down the woman road, you're not going to need a brain. And so if a woman has a brain and she wants to use her brain, she's got to go down the man road, right? I've sometimes joked that atheism has two tenets. There is no God, and I hate him. Okay? Well, feminism has two comparable tenets. Men are jerks, and women should be like them. We have to play by their rules. We have to pursue it their way. No, that's just not true. So, education is teleological. Education is teleological. It's directed to a certain end. The assumption ought to be that boys in the classroom are going to take this information different places than the girls will. This is not a problem. Okay? You teach the same history, you teach the same geography, you teach the same mathematics, and you teach the same science to the kids. But it's an unspoken assumption, if the culture of your school is healthy, everybody there is comfortable with the fact that God has made us male and female. We're comfortable with the fact that we like the guys being guys, and we like the girls being girls, we like the guys being masculine, and we like the girls being feminine, and we fully understand that you're going to do completely different things with the information that we give you. And what you do, if you're thinking about it, it's not going to be a rebellion. The women are not going to take this information and go off and form their own little enclave and then rebelliously defy the guys. And the guys aren't going to do the same thing. They're going to learn how to work harmoniously together, where the men know their shortcomings and honor the women, and the women know their shortcomings and honor the men. Men and women ought to harmonize together. Men and women ought to harmonize. That means that they, in order to harmonize, you have to be completely different notes. Okay? A C and an E and a G harmonize. Okay? It's a C chord. Those notes harmonize, but they're different notes. There are people who want uniformity, and this is another issue. They want uniformity. They want everybody singing the same note. They think that like-mindedness means getting all the girls to act like guys or getting all the guys to act like girls. But that's not harmony. And this goes back to something else that we've been emphasizing a great deal. We are, in the first place, we are Trinitarian Christians. In the first place, you were baptized into the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. You were baptized into the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. What does that mean? All right, what does that mean for your school? I think it means a great deal, and this is something that we have to flesh out. Think of it this way. When when you are baptized into the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, you are being baptized into the name of the one God, three persons. Now, in the ancient world, the Greeks had a problem that's been called by the philosophers the problem of the one and the many. Now, I'm simplifying somewhat. I'm just giving you a 30,000-foot version of this. But basically, they had a problem. Parmenides, the problem was, how do you get, what is ultimate? Is it plurality that's ultimate, or is it unity that's ultimate? What's ultimate? Parmenides taught that everything was one, right? All is one. So the Parmenidean answer was that one is ultimate and diversity is an illusion because one is ultimate. Heraclitus taught that diversity was ultimate. World is king. You can't step into the same river twice and so on. And that therefore unity is an illusion. So the Heraclitians had all this diversity and they couldn't reach the concept of unity. They had all this stuff, but they didn't have a sack to put it in. Okay? The Parmenideans had a sack, but they didn't have stuff. Right? We've got a principle of unity, but we don't have diversity. The Heraclitians had all the diversity, but they didn't have a principle of unity. Along came the Christians and preached God in three persons, blessed Trinity. What is ultimate? Unity or diversity? Yes. What is ultimate? Unity or diversity? Yes. One God, three persons. The one is not antecedent to the three. The three is not antecedent to the one. You have unity and diversity within the Godhead, and that's what makes form and freedom possible. Right? Form. The Parmenideans could have form, but not freedom. The Heraclitians could have freedom, anarchy, but no form. Trinitarians can have form and freedom together. Now, it gets better. Then, the second person of the Trinity, the Word, in Arche and Halagos, in the beginning was the Word of God became flesh and dwelt among us. When that happened, when the Word of God became flesh and dwelt among us, what did He do? Right? Well, He came down, became a man, in order to take a bride. Right? The bridegroom came down in order to take a bride. The Christian church is the bride of Christ. Now, this is the cool thing. When you have Christ coming down, taking the form of a servant, it says in Philippians 2 that He humbled Himself, and even to the death on the cross. Jesus Christ submitted Himself, humbled Himself, and He humbled Himself even to death on a cross. Now, this means that for Christians who believe in the Trinity, submission does not equal inequality. Because it says in Philippians, He did not consider His equality with God something to be grasped, but emptied Himself and took the form of a servant. So, in Trinitarian circles, submission is not a dirty word. Submission is not Muslim submission. Submission is the submission of one equal to another. The second person of the Trinity submitted to and obeyed the first person of the Trinity, and that means that when a Christian wife submits to her husband, she is submitting as one equal to another. And when she submits to him, she is submitting to him in a glorious way, because not only is there no inequality, but there is diversity. You're back at the Trinitarian thing. There's a form and freedom. There's one marriage, right? There's one marriage, but you've got two persons in that marriage, two perspectives within that marriage. And it's not like a power struggle. It's more like a dance, right? It's not a power struggle. It's more like a dance. I saw a great comment one time that Ginger Rogers did everything that Fred Astaire did. She was just as good a dancer as he was. Far better, in fact, because everything he did, she did backwards and in heels, right? So you've got this glorious dance, and it's harmonious. So what you want to do is say to the young men, because they're not going to know how to do this when they're grown and married, unless the parents are teaching it to them in the home, and you are backing the parents up as you teach the same principles in your school. You tell the young men, we want you to sing your note. And girls, we want you to sing your note, and we don't want you singing flat or sharp. We want you to hit the note, and we want you to harmonize with the other. All right? We want you to, here's some things we do at Logos, at Logos School. We want to set a difference, not in the dress code between the guys and the girls, but set a behavioral difference between the guys and the girls. So, for example, when, and this varies, we modify this as the kids get older, but let's say in junior high, when a teacher walks in the room, the entire class stands. When the bell rings and the class is dismissed, the guys remain where they are, all the girls exit first. All the girls leave the classroom first, and then the guys leave behind them. Because this is part of our liturgy of the classroom. We want the guys to say, you're different than the girls, and this difference is to be exploited by you to their benefit, not exploited by you to your benefit. Right? We want to train you and drill in you the fact that when you see a lady, you open the door for her, not because her hand is broke, not because she's incapable of doing it, but because we want to set up these liturgical enactments that tell us that we want men to sacrifice themselves for the ladies. We want men to give way to the ladies. We want them to do this because they are to acknowledge the difference and then to acknowledge that that difference is to be served and honored and respected. Right? That's what you're after. All right. So it's not a problem that the girls are going to take what you teach in a different direction. It's not a problem that the guys are going to take what you're teaching in a different direction, but it is a problem if they take it in a completely different direction and they don't have anything to do with each other. You want them to come together in such a way that what the girls are doing contributes and harmonizes with what the guys are doing. One other practical thing that I want to say before we're done, and this is a tough one. Always remember that what the school receives from the boys and what the school receives from the girls will be different. Not only are the boys and girls different in their future lives, the boys and girls are different in their take on what it means to be a student. All right? Guys, C.S. Lewis comments somewhere that women define love as taking trouble for others. Girls, and that's actually a much more biblical definition of love. It's a Christ-like definition. Women define love as taking trouble for others. Men define love, as Lewis commented, as not giving trouble to others. That's all they can do to manage that. So a man and wife have a couple over, and they have some guests over. Who is most likely to have spent all afternoon in the kitchen cooking? Who's most likely to have cleaned the living room? Who's most likely to want to take their coats and can I get you something to drink? Who's most likely to take an enormous amount of trouble for the guests? Well, not a big secret, the wife, right? And who is most likely to be very proud of himself for not having started a fight with anybody in the course of the evening? Well, live up to what you attained, and that's how far I've gotten. Well, men tend to define love as not giving trouble, and women tend to define love as taking trouble. And, of course, in marriage, men need to love as Christ loved, which means they have to start taking trouble for others. But this is how it plays out in the school. Here's a little thought experiment. There's a teacher, a science teacher, Mr. Smith, is sitting in his classroom in lunch break, having his lunch. And there's a tap on the door, and a group of students appears with lunch bags in hand, and they say to him, do you mind if we come in and have lunch with you? Now, are these students girls or guys? Girls. Now, how'd you know that? Because the guys are down the street at Arby's. Okay? All right. The bell rang. They're not watching over next. Let's get out of here. Let's... And so the guys are oftentimes, and so who is going to, when this science teacher, when the time comes to make nominations or recommendations for thoughtful, agreeable, compliant, cooperative students for the faculty awards, who's going to get the faculty awards? The girls, because they're friendly, they're institution friendly, they want to take trouble, who wants to make sure that we're not causing any trouble, we don't want to give any heartburn to the administration at all? Well, the guys don't care if they give heartburn to the administration at all, And I'm not talking about bad actor guys. I'm not talking about guys who have a problem. Just normal, regular guys. Okay? They're not thinking in that category at all. They think, well, I love my school. It didn't give me any trouble all day. I care about this. This is what I mean by girls are more institution friendly. Girls are more institution friendly. Guys are not as institution friendly, but a guy who's not as institution friendly can be just as godly. Okay? He can love Jesus Christ, love God's people, but he's a boy. He's not going to act like a girl. And the problem is that what we have done in the church is we have, and this is probably the, out of all the things I've said, this is, I would think this is probably the most important thing, is we have defined piety in feminine terms. We have defined piety in feminine terms. Masculine piety scares us. Feminine piety is institution friendly. It's friendly to the school. It's friendly to the church. It's friendly to the family. Masculine piety is frequently disruptive. Masculine piety might get the discussion in the classroom off on something else. Right? So you've got the girls who, and I'm generalizing here, and I know no grief afterwards. I'm generalizing here. I know there are exceptions, and you want to teach to the weaknesses so they don't do this. But girls tend to be very good students. But they also tend, if they have a temptation, they tend to be the kind of good students who ask questions like, will that be on the test? See? Will that be on the test? Because I'm taking notes here, and I want to have everything down that you told me that I needed to know, because I'm going to be a good girl, and I'm going to go home and study. My oldest daughter, Becca, which, remember when she was high school, she would bring notes home and say, Dad, I'm dead. I'm dead for this test. Would you please drill me? And I'd say, okay, I'll drill you. And so I'd take her notes, and it's and normally when you drill a student, you just ask them, so what's this, and they'll tell you. But one time I took the notes from her. I'm dead. And so I took the notes to drill her, and so she began reciting the notes. Just had all her notes basically memorized, but she was dead. And guys, hey, I got a 72. That state of affairs continues until sophomore year in college, the end of sophomore year, when it dawns on the young man that he's going to have to get a job. Well, what happens is oftentimes young men who love God, love their parents, love Jesus Christ, do not express that love the way girls do. They don't express it. They don't manifest it the way girls do. And what we do is we say to the boys, well, and we don't say it overtly, but we say, if you're going to be pious, if you're going to be thought to be devout, if you're going to be thought by us to be a conscientious Christian, you're going to have to act like the girls. And the guys will do one of two things. Some of them comply. Some of them act like the girls. And they get the faculty awards and creep everybody else out. The others say, no, if I want to be a guy, if I want to be a man, if I want to be masculine, it's obvious that I can't be that here. It's obvious that I can't be that kind of person in the church. And so we drive them away. Instead of embracing masculine piety it doesn't exhibit sin or malice or evil or anything like that, but it's just not feminine. Right? So this first occurred to me a number of years ago when we had a girls' basketball team that was just full of a bunch of sweet Christian girls. And when you have a basketball team, they were very good athletes too, but the sweet Christian girl part was seen in all the things that you would predict, praying for each other, and I noticed that you were a little discouraged this morning, so I left a note in your locker, and a note in your locker written with bubble letters, you know. So, you know, and everybody in the world looking at that would see these girls love each other. These girls are encouraging each other and they're praying for each other. And then you walk down the hall and you see a guy knock a friend of his into the locker, and he says, "You fathead," and you go on. Now, that it would never occur to you in a million years to think that the guy was admonishing his brother, right? But let's say that's what he found out his friend had taken a non-Christian girl out the night before, and he popped him one, because that's what you do. You fathead. Now, is that piety? Yes, that's piety. That's godliness. That's exhorting to love and good works. It's just not how the girls do it. Okay? The girls better not do it. When something's seriously pathologically wrong when the girls are doing it that way, and something's pathologically wrong when the guys are acting like the girls. All right, so what you want is a situation where the guys are genuinely masculine. You want a school that grows guys up to be some form of a recognizable vertebrate. More vertebrate males is my motto. More. But you can't be frightened by it, because sometimes not only will a boy who popped his friend and knocked him into the locker for taking a non-Christian girl, not only will that kind of godliness be a difficulty for the friend, but that kind of godliness might raise questions in the discussion period in the classroom that challenge the teacher. And instead of saying, "How dare you challenge the teacher because I'm on my dignity here," that a male teacher particularly ought not to act like a bull elk whose primacy in the herd has been challenged. Right? Because that happens. Some young man starts to probe and question, and the male teacher can get defensive and threatened, but instead he ought to embrace this as a wonderful and a glorious teaching opportunity. This is wonderful. That's a great question. Let's chase it. Let's pursue it. And welcome it. And welcome not the conflict in a malicious sense, but welcome the give and take of intellectual exchange. That's education. That's what we're after. That's what we want to do. Well, let's thank our God together. Father, we thank you. We praise you. We know that without direction from your word, we are all of us lost. I pray that you watch over us and bless us, because we ask for it in Jesus' name. Amen.